I'm Sam Zeff, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Adolescent girls are among the most vulnerable victims when it comes to sex trafficking. Today, the story of one such Kansas teen. The two reporters who followed the story of Hope Zephyrjohn uncovered a narrative happening more often than you would think. A teenage girl who becomes a victim, but is treated as a criminal by the same state that was supposed to protect her. Then, a topic parents can still be reluctant to talk about with their children, sex. Psychologist Wes Crenshaw has some advice on when to have these conversations and how to keep them age appropriate. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. We begin this morning with a KCUR investigation. KCUR's Peggy Lowe, along with Sherman Smith from the Topeka Capital Journal, discovered a trend of girls who were sex trafficked and then ended up in prison. Let's listen to part of the story, which broke on Morning Edition and KCUR.org this morning.
As a child, Hope Joy May Zephyrjohn lived up to her name. Her godmother, Stacy Kelly, says she was a sweet, freckle-faced kid with beautiful blue eyes who liked to be outside.
Hope is extremely full of life and very energetic and very much a tomboy.
There were six kids in the Zephyrjohn home. Kelly says money was scarce and the home was sometimes violent. When Hope was just 14, a man named Anthony Long started hanging out there. He was 24 years old and went by the nickname Angel. In early 2014, police were called to the home on reports of a fight and discovered that the kids weren't going to school.
When the police came into the home, it was full of feces, full of trash and clothes everywhere and roaches out in the daytime because they were so infested and they had horrible bed bugs.
15-year-old Hope was charged with misdemeanor battery and ordered to an out-of-the-home placement, which is like foster care, in Salina. At the time, she considered Anthony Long her boyfriend, and he soon found her. And she quickly learned Anthony, or Angel, had two sides.
I love Angel, okay? Let's say, that's what he was to me. He was, when he treated me good and everything. And then when he became all rude, it's like, where is the one I love? This is just an Anthony, you know? So it's kind of like,
Hope ran away with Long, who brought her back to Topeka. There, he sold videos of them having sex, and he forced her to recruit other girls, sometimes through Facebook.
Peggy Lowe and Sherman Smith join me in the studio. Good morning. Congratulations on this investigation.
Good morning, Sam.
Good morning.
Peggy, let's start at the beginning. How did we get on this Hope Zephyrjohn story?
Well, if you recall about a year and a half ago, October 2017, when the then head of the Department for Children and Families under the Brownback administration, a woman named Phyllis Gilmore, was up before a legislative committee and essentially told lawmakers, we've lost 90 kids. And lawmakers were shocked, and she had a very blasé attitude about it, and she was sort of like, yeah, well, that's kind of the national average, you know, it's okay. So we started looking into it back then, along with the Kansas News Service, and that's when I stumbled upon this story of Hope Zephyrjohn.
Sherman, problems in the Kansas foster care system are systemic, it's rampant. What was it in this investigation that surprised you?
So we've heard some concerns from, you know, child advocates and, you know, legislators from both parties for a long time, kind of sounding alarms in real time. But it's startling to me to sit back and look at kind of the totality of this now, to see that thousands of kids were added to the system, that the number of runaways doubled in 3 years, and to really uncover what the serious consequences are of living on the street.
Essentially, I think we just wanted to go back and say, okay, this happened. Now what's the status? And who is being affected? We truly wanted to profile people on the street, girls and boys on the street.
So from that time that Phyllis Gilmore testified before the Kansas legislature, where she said, you know what, we've lost 90 kids, has it gotten worse? Has there been any progress in improving the situation?
Well, I think a lot of people are concerned that there hasn't really been any progress or much progress. They launched a special team earlier this year with kind of new funding, new resources, 10 people across the state to really try to track these girls down and bring them back in. The numbers were still in the 90s a few months ago. It's now trending down toward around 60 that are missing at any time.
You know, there was a quote in the online story at kcur.org that really struck me from a woman named Karen Countryman Rossworm, who's the director of the Center for Combating Human Trafficking. That's at Wichita State. We've waged war, she said, on the very population that we said we were going to serve. Is it that bad, Peggy Lowe?
It is. And here's what she's speaking to specifically. So here, there's a subset of girls that I talk about in my story today, and it's online at kcur.org and at cjonline.com. And essentially, Ms. Rossworm Countryman has 14 girls. Is it? It's 14. It's 12 and Hope.
13 yes.
Girls, yeah, who fell out of state custody by running away and then fell into the sex trade and then were charged by law enforcement in Kansas as criminals for something they did that they were actually victims of. And so I think that's one of the largest takeaways we have of this subset of girls among all these larger numbers of runaways.
You know, help me hold my hand through this and tell me, how do they... these girls get from being in the foster care system, having foster parents, having some support, and then getting sex trafficked? What is that journey?
Yeah, I've talked to some social workers for this series, and you know, they talk about kids coming into the system who many of them have suffered trauma before they get there. Actually, they say just being taken away from your family is traumatic, and they, you know, they don't necessarily have a way to connect with somebody within the foster care system. There's a lot of bouncing going on, which is where they're staying in a different emergency home night after night after night, so they don't feel safe. They don't really have a way to process that trauma. And a lot of them are just looking for a connection. They talk about how when somebody does go out on the streets, they wind up in these situations where they're trading sex for a place to stay. And that then leads to being under the control of whoever's providing food, drugs, a couch to sleep on.
Sherman has a great quote in a story that we did that's coming tomorrow about, it's one of these providers who said, you know what, it's not like you see it on television. It's not a white panel van pulling up on the street and pulling a little kid off the street. Sometimes it's people they know. Some people it's, you know, sometimes they've come to trust these folks. Like in Hope's case, this was a man who was brought into her home by her sister. Her father befriended this guy. His name is Anthony Long. He is now in prison. And then he was her boyfriend initially. She fell in love with him. And then, of course, he turned into this abusive trafficker of hers. So it doesn't happen like we see it oftentimes in the movies and television.
So tell me more about Hope. I mean, we know that she has this troubled home, troubled youth, but tell me your impressions about her. You interviewed her a couple of times. We just heard from her in your story that was on this morning. Just tell me what your feelings about her.
By all accounts, Hope is a really bright young woman who dreams of the future. She has a son. He's roughly 5, I think, now. She has lost him. His name is Ty. She has lost him to adoption. So that's very hard for her. She says she's going to get out of prison and get Ty back. So we'll see how that goes. But
and how many more years does she have in the Kansas DOC?
She's 21 years old right now. She would get out in 2023. If she doesn't get this pardon that she is now seeking from the governor. So we've sort of buried the lead here, haven't we? She is going after her second request at a governor's pardon. She asked then-Governor Jeff Collier last year for a pardon. He turned her down. She is now submitting the proper paperwork to Governor Laura Kelly, who told us she finds the case sad. She will consider this clemency like she considers all cases. And Kelly also said it points to a larger problem within the Kansas justice system.
Yeah, Hope's particular case happened while former Governor Brownback was in office. Phyllis Gilmore was worked for him. Where is Brownback on this?
Well, and that's what's so interesting, too. And we didn't have time to put that in our radio story, but the story that we have online at the Cap Journal and in Cap Journal editions today, it feels weird to talk about print. I haven't done that for a long time. And it's on KCUR.org. But in May of 2015, Governor Brownback had his picture taken with the Zephyrjohn family,
wow,
touting his family reunification month and how he has reunified, 7% more families than he had the year before. What he didn't mention was that one of the members of that family, Hope, was already being sex trafficked. So I called former Governor Brownback. He is now an ambassador within the Trump administration, and he declined to comment.
So what does the we know what Laura Kelly is going to consider a clemency for young Hope. What about the rest of the state of Kansas? Where is DCF? Where is everybody else on this, Sherman?
I think everybody recognizes that the system has failed and that they need to make broad improvements. There's that 10-member team that we talked about is kind of a key to this strategy.
Tell me more about that before you go on, this 10-member team. Who's on it and what are they supposed to accomplish?
So there are two full-time staff members at DCF and then 8 grant-based positions around the state. DCF officials talk about kind of a 3-pronged strategy, one on preventing runaways. Part of it is on recovering those runaways. They're making calls every day to try to track down these girls. And then the third part of it is engaging these kids within the system, try to find if there's a connection they can make with a teacher or a class at school or some kind of job training program, that sort of thing.
I think what was super interesting is when Sherman and I got a meeting with heads of DCF, and we were kind of going through all the failures that the agency had kind of rung up over the last few years, right? And obviously, this is a new administration. This is Governor Laura Kelly's administration. The last administration, Brownback, we saw a Phyllis Gilmore going, hey, 90 kids are missing. Yeah, that's a national average.
1% of the total population in foster care. It's within the national average, which is true.
That's true. But anyway, so we sat down and Sherman posed a question to the deputy director and he said, okay, so they basically Brownback's administration said, 70 to 90 kids, that's okay. And he said, so in your administration, how many kids is it okay to be as runaways?
Right. I wanted to know if there was like a target or a goal or something. And Tanya Keyes, the deputy secretary, just said very flatly, 1 is too many.
And I was pretty amazed by that. We walked out of that office and I said, well, it's a new day at DCF.
Yeah, losing 70 to 90 kids, 1%, seems to be what they're saying, just the cost of doing business. Yet the Kelly administration, how do you think, let me just follow up on and pressure on that a little bit. Is it even possible to get that number down to zero?
Well, I don't think it's possible to get it down to zero, but I think they can, get it down to a manageable number. I'm not sure what that number is, but they're looking to the advice of kind of researchers, experts across the country to figure out what those strategies are, how to identify, who's at flight risk and how to really keep kids engaged.
So Hope wasn't the only person you found in these circumstances. Tell me about some of the others.
That's right. So we sat down with 3 other of the survivors. They were at the Center for Combating Human Trafficking at Wichita State. And it was remarkable that all 4 of these survivors now that I've talked to, their stories sound so similar, no matter where they come from, no matter their ethnicity, no matter their age. Essentially, they run away from some sort of state custody. Hope was in under the Department of Corrections. Other of these girls were within DCF. They run away. They fall into sex trafficking. One of the young women was trafficked by her mother. And then all of a sudden, they told us this story, and it'll be in our day 2 story tomorrow, too. For some reason, there's a line crossed at some point that they still don't quite know what that is. At first, they'll enter the system, and all law enforcement will say, you're a victim. We're going to save you. We're going to rescue you. We're going to make it okay. Then the line is crossed where they're saying, you're a perpetrator. You're going to jail for the rest of your life. See ya. So that's kind of that remarkable little space that Advocates for Hope and these other girls are trying to make better.
And the other component of that is the way that prosecutors approach this with all of these victims has been to throw a lot of different felony charges at them. With Hope, it was 10 felonies and some misdemeanors. And they've, you know, they're faced with the prospect at being, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old and being incarcerated for another 15, 20 years. And so they take the plea deal that'll get them out in 4 or 5.
What happens in much of the justice system. What's the Shawnee County DA who brought these charges? What does he say about this?
So the Shawnee County DA is a man named Mike Kagay, and he wasn't the DA when Hope's case went through. That said, I had a sit down with him, and he was really forthcoming. Like I was kind of surprised at how thoughtful he was about this, because he said, you know what, prosecutors weren't unsympathetic to Hope Zephyrjohn. They saw that she'd been trafficked. They saw she'd been coerced. They saw that she had been abused by this boyfriend slash pimp. That said, he said, we didn't charge the other girls that were in that sex ring with, you know, Zephyrjohn. We let them go. And one of them, who is Hope's victim, said she needs to be in prison. So we honored that. And he said, we took those 10 felonies down to just one. So there needs to, he basically said, there needs to be some accountability here.
Is that what we hear with these other girls that you've talked to, Sherman?
Well, I think what we hear over and over again is that they didn't have any control over their lives, that there's a violent figure that was telling them what they had to do, that they had to recruit somebody, that they had to do certain things that were illegal, and they felt like they didn't have any option because, you know, the threat of physical violence is always there.
Or death.
Or death, yeah.
Oftentimes, you know, they said, their trafficker said, I'll kill you if you don't do this. And in Hope's case, her trafficker said, I'll kill your son. I'll kill your family. I know where they are.
She said that she had miscarrages, right, as a result of
twice,
this.
Twice, because he beat her so
severely.
Because
of the beatings that she took from him.
That's right.
Right. So part two tomorrow on KCUR. Tell me about that.
So Sherman and I will be on KCUR tomorrow morning talking about what we found as far as the numbers and as far as what prosecutions are going on. And certainly we're going to hear, too, from some of those survivors. So.
What do they say?
Well, they talk about how they felt lost in the foster care system, that they didn't have any help there, why they felt they had to run away, and, you know, just kind of that helplessness throughout the process. One of the girls talks about, you know, not being able to call her mother from the juvenile detention facility, and her mother actually dies while she's behind those bars. Mm-hmm. And she felt like she couldn't navigate the legal system, and so she took a plea deal. You know, we hear from child advocates who say, you know, the decision to pull back kind of hundreds of millions of dollars in annual funding for food assistance and mental health treatment really led to struggling families not being able to care for children. And that's really a part of why the system adds 2,000 kids over the course of 7 or 8 years.
So pulling back on SNAP benefits, which also happened during the Brownback administration, correct?
SNAP and TANF.
Yep, yep.
Aid to families. They cut it back.
Let me just wrap it up by asking you, I read the story, I listened to the story, I've talked to you. I am emotional enough right now thinking about these kids, and I'd like to know your feelings about it.
I found it extremely emotional. The day I sat down with the three survivors in Wichita was one of the most incredible experiences I've had in a long, long, long career here. Pardon me. I've been at this more than 30 years. And their remarkable strength and resiliency and the fact that they have this fierce advocate in Karen Countryman Rosworm, that's pretty remarkable. And then the night I talked to Hope, I was with her two pro bono attorneys. It was on the phone. And that was a pretty emotional night for all three of us. We're sitting in one of our little production booths, right? Me and her two attorneys. And she's crying on the phone and beating herself up for feeling like, you know, she was cruel to her family or the victims. And it's just been a pretty emotional journey, yeah. Thanks for asking.
Sherman Smith?
Yeah, it's startling to to hear these voices say things like, look at me like I'm a human, I'm not an it. You know, those things, they give you pause. But you also hear from social workers and child advocates who, you know, I think they just feel so worn down of trying to help individuals like this. And
that's true.
They feel a little helpless as well.
Yeah. Sherman Smith from the Topeka Capital Journal, my KCOR bunkie, Peggy Lowe, making a difference with a KCOR Topeka Capital Journal investigation. Thank you both for being here this morning.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Stay with us when we return, when to teach sex ed and what to teach. I'm Sam Zeff. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Sam Zeff. You're back on Up to Date here on KCUR 89.3. Are you a big fan of Up to Date? I bet you are. You can get more from Steve Kraske every Monday with his weekly newsletter, Kraske Off Mic. You can have it delivered to your inbox, by the way, by signing up at kcur.org/Kraske. You don't want to miss it. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to subscribe. Tomorrow, you hear his music on this program every day. It's the great Bobby Watson. He's ending his academic career at UMKC soon. We'll ask the jazz ambassador, what is next? Right now, though, over the last 10 years, we've seen an uptick in the sexual awareness among kids in middle and high school. The reason? The internet has overtaken school and family as a primary form of sex education. And that has parents wondering how young is too young to start the sex talk. Dr. Wes Crenshaw is a Lawrence family psychologist and certified sex therapist, and he's back with us on Up to Date. Wes, good morning.
Good morning, Sam.
If you want to jump in on the conversation, the number is 816-235-2888, or you can tweet your question to us. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tell us how you approach this conversation with your children, or if you're considering it now, well, you can share your concerns. Wes, you think it's time for parents to just give up on the birds, bees, and sex talk. Yeah. Why do you think that?
Yeah, it's ask a parent, ask a kid. Nothing is more awkward than one day you're driving down the road and your parent says, there's something I've been wanting to talk to you about. And the kid's like, oh, God, here comes the sex talk. Nothing so awkward as that. And it's not the way to approach the situation at all. You just can't jump out from behind a bush and start talking about sex when somebody's 13.
You know, two questions here. One, you make it sound, and I think that if I go back to my own parental experience, that you decide to have the sex talk for no reason at all.
Usually,
right? Just
usually
right, that you're driving down the road. Right. That all of a sudden you've got the wherewithal to do it.
Yeah.
Why do we do that?
Well, because people are procrastinators. Now, I want to say, in the years we've been talking about this, it's gotten a lot better. It's getting better. I see parents more competently able to do this now than I ever have in 27 years of practice. But a lot of people still are procrastinating this because they're so uncomfortable with it. And so when they get panic-stricken about something, let's say their child is going on their, you know, their first hangout session with a desired partner, or they're going to a dance, or they see something on television that scares them, then they go into sort of emotional reactivity mode and start wanting to talk about this kind of out of the blue. And what really needs to happen instead is this needs to be an ongoing conversation. I always said if people are able to talk about the Chiefs and the Royals and, of course, the Jayhawks, if you can talk about those things at dinner like people do so often, you can talk about sex. It's just another human experience that we can learn to discuss with kids.
Does it make a difference how you were informed about this as a child when you become a parent?
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. And this is part of the reason it is getting better, is that we have a new generation of parents that are coming on that had a better experience, hopefully, with their parents, or at least they know they need to have a better experience. But traditionally, people are replicating what they grew up with, which is this kind of shame-filled, scary, emotionally reactive relationship with the sex talk.
Yeah. By the way, shame-filled and scary is exactly how I talk about the Jayhawks these days.
Now.
So when are kids ready for the sex talk, do you think?
Well, so you got to kind of understand this broader picture of the sex conversation, this ongoing conversation. And so I'm not being flippant when I say as soon as they can communicate. One of the odd things that has happened in the last few years is you'll get some folks of a certain ideology that see any discussion of sexuality with kids as, quote, sexualizing the kids. And if you're talking about body parts, or you're talking about relationships or consent, very important, these are all things that you should talk about from the time children can communicate. So one example, we're not big fans of forcing the cat to get a hug, or to force little kids to get a hug. Those are consent discussions. People might not think of that as related to sexuality, but obviously it is. And so if you teach people you have to hug grandma, you're really teaching little people that they have to, you know, succumb to someone else's will, and none of us want that. So little conversations like that early on are very important.
They talk about that a lot in daycare when kids go there, and in early years when they're in school, in kindergarten especially. How do you fit those talks in with what you're supposed to do as a parent?
Well, any point of interaction that kids have, whether it's in daycare or with the teacher in daycare or with the peers, these are rich opportunities to help guide people in proper interaction. And parents, I think, sometimes are a little too reactive to what other people are doing to their kid and not as noticing of what their kid is doing to others. And so if you get a report, for example, in daycare that the child's invading other people's boundaries, and it may be just, you know, lovingly, maybe the family's a big bunch of huggers, for example, or they're maybe not invading someone's boundaries so kindly. Those are things that begin a conversation that eventually becomes about how you treat a partner. And that conversation may come sooner now than later. It's quite interesting to me how sophisticated middle schoolers are now about sexuality. They can teach a sex ed class better than we could teach them.
That's changed over your 27 years. I mean, when did this change with everybody having, you know, high speed internet?
That is a big part of it. I'll tell you, I almost hate to say this. I used to not like to see middle schoolers because I didn't think they were that interesting to work with. And now they are just the most fascinating people ever. And a lot of that is because they have acquired much of it online, and also through conversation with each other, people being online and then sharing that. They've acquired a language about sexuality. And I cannot prove this statistically, but through clinical contact, if ever there was a case to be made for sex education, it is in middle school right now, because the more they are talking about it, and they talk about gender identity, and they talk about attraction profiles, and all sorts of issues, the more they talk about it, the less they're going out and having what we call PV sex, penis-vagina sex. They're having less of that now because they're talking about it and actually discussing all aspects of sexuality openly. And I see fewer kids actually engaged now as they are engaged in conversation, less engaged in the physical acts.
Yeah, you have a question about sex education, a comment? You know you do, by the way. 816-235-2888 to jump in on our conversation right now. So how do you help you in your practice help parents manage their emotions around these difficult talks?
Yeah, if you can get to them quick enough, you start helping them practice early on before some of this stuff comes up. And I try to teach people to assume a bunch of things will be coming up in their lives. This whole thing about, you know, where babies come from, boy, that is the easiest conversation to have. You know, you get some great graphics online and you show sperms and eggs, and there's some cartoonish ones. It's fun. That's about a 10-minute conversation. the larger conversation is one that is more emotionally evocative for people. And so we propose you practice, you know, what else should you do on I-35 going out to the suburbs in traffic? You talk to yourself and pretend you're giving a discussion or having a discussion with your kid, and imagine that the child, you know, is having gender identity issues or sexual attraction issues. And these things come sometimes before middle school. So an early conversation with yourself about that is helpful. And then we also have what we call the PLUS model, which will appear in our consent-based sex education books. Pause, listen, understand, and be sex positive is the PLUS model. And that should just start very early on as you are working with kids. The more calm you are, the more calm the kid will be.
So you're saying that these questions from your children can happen at any time.
Yes.
And you just need to be prepared so that you don't look panicked.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the times, if we don't teach kids that it's awkward to talk about sex, they're not going to think it's awkward to talk about sex. So the more, and I see this now with families, these kind of new generation of families come in. In the last 6 months, I have had what I would have counted as the most awkward conversations with young, typically young women in the office with their parents there. We've never been able to do this. And I turn to the kid and I say, is it okay that we're talking about this? And she'll say, yeah, it's okay. And the parents are in the game at this point. Now, is that everybody? It is not, but it shows we're making some progress.
Ellen from Overland Park, you're on with Wes Crenshaw.
Oh, hi, Wes.
Hi.
So I'm a grandmother. I grew up in that time where the only sex education we had, particularly because of Catholic schools, was don't do it, or, you know, you're a bad girl. As a grandmother of three children, I'm a big proponent of talking about sex from a very early age and talking about relationships and sex. And sex in and of itself, masturbation, whatever, but my real big concern is that too many children are becoming addicted to online porn by the time they're 9 and 10 years old. And that is where too many get to their education about what sex is. And it is as close to sex, porn is, you know, as, you know, as throwing a rock is to shooting a machine gun. It has absolutely nothing to do with sex, and it has everything to do with, you know, with violence and contemptuousness. And too many young children are being harmed physically as well as emotionally, and disconnecting them from the humanity between individuals and sexual partners. And I don't know, your mother didn't get rid of it. How do I, as a grandmother, with a daughter who, you know, certainly is, I'm able to talk to about this, and I'm part of the whole group helping the kids, but how do we do this? You know, when, you know, my 10-year-old granddaughter in 2 or 3 years is going to be kissing boys who have, or trying to, who have learned that not until you have taking care of me orally will I even kiss you. What do we do for them?
Wes, what do we do?
Well, so we've done two good shows over the years on pornography on UpToDate. And if you just Google UpToDate, KCUR, and my last name, they will show right up. I think they're also on our website. And we go into pretty good depth about all the issues you're talking about. But here's the short version, because it's a good question. Kids, and do not presume in any way that it is only boys. Girls are increasingly consumers of pornography. They consume it very differently, however, than do boys. And your point about it being pretty early, I looked for the show today, and I can't quite find a good number that I believe is reliable on when kids have first exposure to pornography. That most of the statistics say about 12 to 13. I think that's probably old. I think that that is probably younger now, because, you know, there, it's, you've got to really work at filtering that material or they're going to have access to it. A lot of people will filter their computer and then don't filter the phone or the tablet. And it's not super high tech to do that. There are different apps you can put on there that will restrict the flow of information. But in the end, the only opportunity you really have to influence that is to have good conversations with kids about what you see as healthy sexual expression, because there's a competing message out there that you're going to want to work against. And what too many parents do, and grandparents, is to just kind of not have the conversation. And if you're up against the internet, you have to be a persuasive, almost evangelical person. And I don't mean that in the religious sense, but in the selling the values you believe sense. Because particularly, and you kind of alluded to this, pornography's general bent, as we've discussed in other shows, is towards violence and degradation of women. And I don't mean as an accident. It's like a big part of their marketing. That's what's interesting. And we did another show once about that very issue. So if you look those up, I think they will be good guidance.
How do you talk to your kids about pornography without shaming them?
Yeah, very fine question. Because, and you, first of all, and I agree with everything the caller said, except be careful using the word addictive. That's a word we watch out for in the sex education industry, because it's probably not the best model to understand. So you want to, kids see this material as about like anything else on the internet now. That's changed in the 10 years we've been talking about this. Kids just sort of, it's just there and it's just a way they learn. So you've got to give the values to it. You've got to be able to say to them, here's what I think is important, and not you're wrong for liking X, Y, or Z. And that's where the plus model comes in. If you really listen and understand, and you, when you're doing the understanding part, you alluded to this earlier, Sam, you've got to not just understand your kid, you've got to understand you and your response to this. Why? And everybody may think, like, what? When I say, wonder why you're so upset about this pornography, for example. If you will sit and wonder about that a little bit, you may notice some new things you're thinking. It just shouldn't be an automatic reaction. You've got to think these things through. But, and then you, when you approach the child, they're going to notice that you're being thoughtful and non-judgmental. And if you're not those things, you're not going to have much of a conversation.
Do you have to take into account that, you know, humans are different, even if they have your own DNA? As your child is getting older, their approach to sexuality could be quite a bit different than yours.
Absolutely.
And do you have to measure all of that?
We have a whole chapter in the Consent-Based Sex Education, Book 1, about differentiation parenting. And the idea being that your goal is not to invent a mini-me. Your goal is to support your child's differentiation from you. And they may have a different attraction profile than you. They may be attracted to same-sex partners. They may be attracted to both gender or all genders of partners. So yes, and they may have a different view of what it means to be sexual. There are those who are identifying now as what's called ace or asexual. There are a whole range of things that parents may not have themselves thought of before that they need to be prepared to explore with their kids as very different people, DNA or not.
You know, I'm feeling, even though my son is now almost 27, I am feeling really overwhelmed by all this information.
Yeah.
Thankful that my son is 27 and not 7. So, you know, help me with this. You know, I can't be the only one listening to this conversation feeling overwhelmed. So, you know what? Find some way to help me here.
Here's how bad it is, Sam. When we went to start writing these books, it's been several years now we've been working on it. I have a wonderful co-author that works with me, a young adult, was a high school student when she started. And we thought this was going to be a manageable project. And this now is 1,000 pages, 4 books at 1,000 pages of material just for parents to be ready to deal with all these issues. So in starting out young with kids, the good news is if you will begin this in the elementary years, it will be such a natural experience. And if you will read and keep track of this admittedly overwhelming material, it's just a natural experience. When you sit down and think about all the things people know, I'll go back to the sports thing. People just know so much, and sports isn't my thing, it's my wife's thing, and she knows every player on the Chiefs and where they went to college, and I don't know that she can quote all their stats, probably she can, I don't know, but that's a lot of knowledge, and I think you just have to be able to embrace that kind of learning with something that really is not only core to our culture, but, you know, our propagation of the species and everything else, and not a lot is more important in our world than sexuality.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you would draw the sports analogy, right? Because now, you know, you watch a football game, and there's a lot of talk about the run-pass option. And now they just abbreviate it to the RPO. Like you're supposed
knows.
To know what the hell that means, right? It's and with so much more information available, both in school and online, it feels like it's a fire hose. And when you push it through the filter of sexuality, which, as you say, is a cornerstone of a relationship and propagation of the species, you didn't really help me there not feel overwhelmed. Is what I'm saying.
I think the 1,000 pages probably didn't help, did it? It really, I'll tell you from the more one-to-one personal level. And I have 25 of these I could do, but recently had a case of a middle schooler who was identifying transgender. And, you know, what most people would, a small town person in the state, and most people would begin to worry about, you know, bullying and how will they be accepted in their school and how will their parents accept anything. And in this younger parent's world, they embraced this. They came to the therapist not to correct the child or anything else, but to help facilitate this process. They came with a lot of information. They asked for a lot more information. Their interface with the school and with a court for name changes and birth certificate changes in Kansas, small town Kansas, has been just lovely. The school has been supportive. So when you see people starting, and they've always been very open with their child. We went back and, you know, we study this when you're doing this kind of work. They've always had a very open, close relationship with the child. So in this case and several others, the child came to them first. And this is unprecedented. Well, it's becoming less unprecedented. Historically, a child was out to everybody before they would go to the parent. Yeah. In these cases, they can go to the parent first. So these folks they're not encyclopedias. They're not professors of sex education. They were just people who really built an open conversation so that as the child aged, their experience and knowledge aged, and it didn't feel as overwhelming. In fact, they're like the least overwhelmed people I've met in a long time. It's quite remarkable, and I have a number of those examples.
Yeah. 816-235-2888. There's still some time to get your question in for Wes Crenshaw about sex education, how to talk to your kids. I want to keep going just for a second on transgendered. This is something that I think it's not new, but I think the discussion of it, the open discussion of it, the bringing in, I mean, I have a friend who teaches in the Shawnee Mission District who says it's unusual now to not go through the day and have a transgender student. So talk to me about how that additional talk that you may have with your kid.
So in an ideal scenario, and I should mention on my posted on my blog the CECAS guidelines for very specific age-appropriate developmental language. And it is inclusive of this idea of understanding gender as somewhat fluid and non-binary. So there are a number of changes in language. I'll give you a simpler one to ease us into it. With my kids and with any kid I work with, I always say, so are you partnered? Do you have a dating partner? how is your partner? Making it neutral so that, first of all, sexual attraction isn't assumed to be opposite. Using the same approach with gender, you can, talk to people about what's your friend's pronouns, for example. It is now common to see people list their pronouns after their name. Having that conversation with just taking out some of your assumptions that your child is going to be friends with or be in a dating relationship with someone who is what we refer to as cisgender, it's just something you have to kind of change your language for, even with young kids.
Richard from KCK, you're on Up to Date with Wes Crenshaw.
Hi. About 20 years ago, I was a volunteer at one of my kids' elementary schools in Liberty, and their computer started running slower in the library. I got on to try to figure out why, and it was maxed out with porn that fifth graders had figured out how to get past the parental control function. That's when we need to start the discussion of sex ed, fifth grade. This was 20 years ago,
yeah,
not middle school.
That's a good story. Oh, yeah. It points out that this isn't just brand new, is it? The battle to try to filter, it's like an arms race, filter and get around, filter and get around. And so while I am the main reason I'm for filtering is because you're sending a message, whether it's the school or the family, you're sending a message that says, we don't think this is a great material for you to see. One of the interesting things on a previous Up-to-Date that came up was whether parents should curate pornography for their kids. We had a guest in, that young college woman, who was proposing that would be a good idea. And she made very rationally, I don't want to argue against her, but in the book, I actually lay out why that's not a great idea, other than it's creepy. But beyond that, it's just, we don't want to be saying, hey, here's the porn you should look at, despite some logical arguments to the contrary. But we really have to be able to describe what the porn is without saying, here's some good porn. We say, I have a list of things that I think are important. Consent-based, non-coercive, it shows some relational characteristics, that it's technically correct. A huge percentage of pornography just isn't even technically correct. It's like the earlier caller said. I say it's like learning about animals from watching Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. It's not accurate material. Those are the kind of things to share with kids without saying, hey, here's some good porn.
Dr. Wes Crenshaw, always nice to have you here on Up to Date. You mentioned some material on your website. Where do we find it?
Familypsychological.com. Very simple. And you can also link it through my Dr. Wes, dr-wes.com. And I've listed all those guidelines, and parents can check them off like a little checklist from CECAS.
Wes Crenshaw, thanks very much.
Good to be here.
Friday on the show, why municipal IDs would benefit thousands of Wyandotte County residents. Hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Give us a follow on the Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate. I'm @SamZeff. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, the composer of Up-to-Date's theme is here. Bobby Watson will talk about drawing his academic career to a close and what's next for the internationally renowned saxophonist. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Sam Zeff. You're up to date.